This episode of Going There features some content that may be uncomfortable for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
In our last episode, we discussed purity culture and spent some time talking through a resource from the Purity Culture Dropout series titled My Sexual Values Workbook. We had to learn more and do a deeper dive. So we hopped in the van and traveled to the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, checking into our hotels right as the Phillies won their spot to go to the World Series in late 2022.
World Series! World Series!
So we could have a chance to sit down with the renowned author of this workbook. So we finally made it, and it brought us here to a co-work space, and we have with us the one and only Erica Smith. This is the Going There podcast.
You better get comfortable, because now we're going there. Taboo Topics are back on the table.
So we're obviously in a different space than we normally are, but it's because we are about to have an awesome one-on-one conversation with the Erica Smith. And yes, I do have to put the in front of it. And while the situation isn't ideal, and it's like on this tiny bench, but intimacy is what she's all about, so we might as well make an intimate conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for meeting with us.
I'm so happy to do this, and the high production value is a pretty new experience for me, so I feel very fancy right now.
We've definitely done our homework and watched a bunch of your stuff, and
oh, cool.
I believe we follow you on Instagram. And recently, I watched the video where I was like, I learned something on the internet today, which is all female mammals have a clitoris.
Absolutely. That's my favorite, like, sex biology fact.
Not only is that, like, a really cool, like, nature fact, but it's important when debunking purity culture, because so many people are like, God created sex for this. And even, you know, you go into, like, real biblical stuff, and it's like, sex is for procreation, then why is there this pleasure
right.
center?
Then why does a dolphin have a clitoris?
Yeah. You know? Well, we all know dolphins are rapists and perverts, right?
Dolphins are, yeah, their morals are not great.
They're all over the place. No, yeah, I mean, that should tell you everything there is to know about sex. And something, you know very little about me, but what you know, I've shared on the show, and we'll definitely talk a little bit as we go through this stuff, is I was raised in an evangelical setting, and sex was so demonized. And, you know, there's this like dual reality of like, well, but when you have a wife, it'll be very pleasurable and God will be in the room with you. I'm like, taping? Like, what's going on? And it's nonsense. It's such nonsense. So you created a program that actually I at least partially went through, and tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I have been a sex educator for a very long time. I've been a sex educator my entire career. Like, that's the only thing I've ever really done. And during my whole span of my career, I obviously noticed that people that were denied facts about sex and denied even a place to like process about it and were raised with shame and fear about it were struggling in ways that other people like couldn't even imagine.
Right.
And so I started really listening to the voices of people who were coming out of fundamentalist religions. And Linda K. Klein's book, Pure, was definitely instrumental in that. I always shout her out because her book was very eye-opening. And it was around the time she released it that I started asking people, you know, were you raised in purity culture? Did it do anything to you long term? And the responses I got were like flooded in. And I was like, it's about time, like, somebody from my field or from my, you know, the sex education world addresses this issue specifically. Yeah. And addresses it with, like, compassion and understanding and being informed of the trauma that people have gone through and tailored sex education just for the people that were raised this specific way. So that's why I did it.
So I know from my side, you know, your name is synonymous with sex education. And I'm not just saying that, like, it really is. And you talk to people and meet people through this whole process from all across the country, and they know your name. From your side of it, when did you notice that all of a sudden there was this like outpouring of people who understood and knew who you were? Was there a moment in time that defined it?
It's still kind of new to me. Because, you know, the internet breeds niche micro celebs. Yep. And I would say that I am a niche micro celeb in this specific area. So there are even parts of like the general sex education world that is very broad that might not know my work. But within the like deconstruction community and the ex-evangelical community, I know that my name is out there. And the funniest example is recently my husband was at a he is a social worker, and he was at a conference in Puerto Rico a couple weeks ago. And somebody came up to him and said, "Are you Erica Smith's husband?" And I thought that was the funniest thing.
The fact that, like, they knew your husband is wild.
I know, because I sometimes put him on my stories and on my account. Yeah. And, you know, he's very like cute and distinct looking. So, yeah, somebody approached him and was like, "You're Mr. Erica Smith." So that was like,
you know, you've made it. When they recognize your spouse,
my spouse,
they're going to be taking pictures of him at the beach and stuff like that. Who's wearing what at the beach?
Right.
How are you related? 6 degrees of separation from Erica Smith. So you've openly talked a lot about the fact that, you know, I was surprised because when I first heard about you and went through it, I was like, oh, this person must have gone through, he must have been raised in this setting. But you weren't.
I was not.
You were still... I'm assuming raised in kind of a somewhat open environment, but sounds like there was some identity crisis. And I remember seeing like the Happy Chasing Amy day,
which. So my background is that, like, I'm from a family that I call us casually Christian, like culturally Christian.
Right.
We went to church on Christmas Eve sometimes. We were those people that your people probably looked down upon.
No. Yeah.
You know, like, everything, we celebrate Christian holidays, but in a pretty secular way, you know, Easter baskets and Christmas presents. But when I was growing up, I thought hell was for rapists, murderers, and people like Hitler. Right. I was never told that hell was for a people like me, like little kids and everyone else. And to me, God was, you know, nice, and your grandma went to heaven and your dead dog went to heaven. So that was my like... very
where
light.
Was that shit when I was growing up? Because I gotta say, like, we bash organized religion all the time.
Yeah.
I still appreciate I still appreciate some of the formality or just, you know, traditions in religion in general, and I respect like crazy the faith. I still have, I would say, a faith. It looks nothing like what I was raised on. Mm-hmm. But that's to me, that's super healthy.
I mean, I was never afraid.
I don't believe in hell, but I want to believe there's a hell for Hitler.
For Hitler, right?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I was never afraid. I never had, you know, now I have a lot of friends who grew up evangelical, and they talk about, you know, the terror and the OCD they had as children, being afraid they were going to do something wrong and go to hell. And I was like, I was never taught that hell was for people like me.
Yeah, for just existing because you're different. Yeah.
Right. And my family is very open about almost everything. I'm from a solidly blue-collar, working-class, like, rural Pennsylvania family. No pretense, no fanciness. We're just people that are... I think other people might consider us crass, or be like, oh, I can't believe they'd make jokes about dicks at the dinner table. But, like, that's what my family's like.
Yeah.
I mean... sex was never a taboo topic. It was always something that was kind of joked about. My mom had 5 sisters, and I would listen to their conversations. And, you know, even my grandparents were super open about it. And so I never was raised with any kind of stigma around it and any kind of shame around it. I wasn't like raised by people who were intentionally like, we are raising shame-free kids. There wasn't that intention.
Right.
I don't think it would have occurred to them.
So they probably weren't raised in a shamey way either.
Right.
Because as we know, you know way more about this, but it's the generational trauma
For
that,
sure.
that, you know, in some ways in learning about this and myself, I feel bad for my parents because they were raised in the same way.
Yeah.
And all they did was pass it down. But our generation felt it that much harder.
Of course.
There had to be some kind of impetus that pushed you into wanting to do this type of work specifically, not just, well, no one else is doing it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the root of a lot of it started with my own, I developed a pretty feminist sense of politics at a young age. And again, it wasn't a thing that anyone taught me. I was just observing the things in the world around me.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, I don't think it's fair that this teacher thinks girls are good or bad at math. And I don't think it's fair that women do all the housework. And I noticed this stuff as a child, you know. Yeah. I assume I can swear on your podcast.
Fuck yes.
Okay, good. I was like, I noticed this shit as a child. And so I had a pretty strong feminist identity in high school. And I also was very open about sex with all my friends. And we became sexually active, most of us in high school. And we're making really healthy decisions about it. Yeah. So I had all these close girlfriends and we would talk about this stuff. And I realized that like I was kind of the friend that everyone would go to be like talking about their problems. And by the time I was in college, I was studying women's studies, which is now mostly known as gender studies. But I was in college. I went to college in 1997. So it was still women's studies. And the classes that I liked the most focused on sexuality and not just sex in the reproductive, you know, this is how people do it and have pleasure aspect, but in the like the sociological aspect of it. So we would learn a lot about different cultures and different ways that like, I remember specifically learning about like birth control being tested on like poor women and immigrant women and sterilizations happening of Black women. And all of these things just made me be like, this is the stuff that gets me really fired up. And so my specialization in college was then like women's health and wellness. And my first job out of college was actually in abortion care. I worked in an abortion clinic and I was 21, 22. And I learned more on that job than I can even imagine ever learning in a classroom.
Right.
And that was when I really got the clear picture of how the Christian right was operating.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I was in abortion clinic work around, I was there during like 9/11 and all that time in history. And Operation Rescue was really huge and some other big anti-abortion groups who were linked to violence. And our clinic was not immune to that. Like we actually got a letter from a group called the Army of God when I was working there. And it said like, Jesus, we're going to kill all of you.
And that's the scary thing. And I've had this fight with my parents as I was trying to tell them that if you actually understood the facts about the abortion care, like the healthcare side of abortion and what people that you think are the good guys are actually doing, not just that, but the misinformation and disinformation that they're putting out there and what happens in these centers where, I mean, it's all based on lies.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the paradox of Christianity is supposed to be like the search for the truth and like living the truth. And it's like, you're living horse shit. Like, this is all nonsense.
Yeah.
And yeah, my parents, it's just no. And I, you know, I try to be as objective as I can. I'm so unfair with my family sometimes, but it's like, you know, you still perpetuated these lies to us and now I'm trying to unpack them. And I don't think that's rare in the sense that you're probably talking to people largely in their 30s, 40s, and 50s unpacking it, because the big push on purity culture started in the 80s, into the 90s and the early 2000s. So, you know, I'm only, you know, I'm right about in that same cusp generation that you are.
Yeah, I'm 43. You're 40.
And I'll be 41.
Yeah, you're so, like Zennial.
Yeah, Zennial. Cusper, yeah, we actually did an episode on generation gaps and I brought somebody boomer to Z and I got to sit right in the middle as that Cusper. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't identify as any of you. I hate all of you. Get off my lawn. No. Yeah, so, it, you know, the purity ring, the... And obviously part of it was based on, we don't want people to get AIDS. AIDS was an epidemic. But the problem is it was partnered with the lie of, well, the gays,
yes,
it's the gay disease and God's punishing us. But just to be safe,
when all that stuff was going on, like purity culture was rising, I was already a sex educator and I was already actually working specifically in HIV prevention and public health. And I was seeing from my end all of the funding go towards abstinence-only education.
Yeah.
Millions and I think billions of dollars. And meanwhile, I'm working in an HIV prevention program for young people. And we had to fight and claw to get funding. And a lot of times we would come up short. And meanwhile, I'm seeing all these abstinence-only programs getting bankrolled fully and also seeing the science that they don't fucking work.
Yeah.
So like, you know, when I tell people why I help people who were raised Christian and in purity culture, it's like, sure, I know you all need it, but I also feel like I have like a vendetta against all the way that during my career as a sex educator and doing abortion care and doing HIV prevention, I was watching the religious right suck up all the funding, suck up all the resources and use it to harm people and not do any good about it.
Yeah.
So when I meet people that were raised in evangelical purity culture and who experienced that side of it, I feel like I'm getting some sort of, I get a lot of satisfaction out of being like, well, I will help you now. Like, yeah. You didn't ask for that. That was that was just something that happened to you by, you know, sheer luck of how you were raised. And it's unfair and it's fucked up. And I'm like, I will take you and I will teach you.
The funniest part of this, I don't know if it's funny, but the most ironic part of it is you're doing what Jesus would do.
Oh.
You're like, give me your, you know, it's like you're taking the most broken, the most damaged, the unwanted, the lepers of the sexual and evangelical community and saying, come to me, I'll help you and I'll show you love.
I never thought about it that way.
That's the most Christ-like thing you can do.
That's so awesome.
Anyone who's had to deconstruct their own faith and religion, I think, sees it like that. Mm-hmm. The people who have been demonized by the church are typically the most Christ-like people that there are. And whether or not you believe in Christ or whatever, what he stood for, what the character is in the Bible, I mean, and it's the same kind of calling I have. That's why this show exists, because I felt like there's not enough people who look like me who go out there and say the stuff that makes people uncomfortable on the other side.
Right.
I guess what you're doing is I try to use my privilege for good.
Yeah.
I will go places and people are like, oh, he's one of us. And
that allows you to hear conversations you never want to fucking hear.
Yeah. But it's also gotten me very excommunicated from my former relationships in life. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it's like, oh, you've been poisoned by the liberal Democrats and all this. And I find myself to be a very objective, middle-of-the-road person. I think season two, the premise is we all live more in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of us left of center, but even a little right of center. The extremists are the ones who are like, even though I might agree with this person on their politics, they're constantly trying to tell you, everybody who voted Republican is evil and blah, blah, blah. It's like, there's a lot of good people.
I so strongly disagree with all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you probably get it from both sides too, because being a personality, basically, it's like everyone wants perfection.
Oh yeah,
and perfection
is the
purity culture. That's what I mean.
Political purity culture.
When you strive for perfection, perfection is everything that's wrong with religion. It's everything that's wrong with like what's happening in our country, around the world, even with white supremacy. Yeah. All of those things are predicated on the strive for perfection. I was going to tell you from the beginning, feel free to correct me when I still think in the binary sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so when you hear me say females or males or women or men, usually I'm referring to it from the historical church's perspective.
Oh, I do the same thing. And I make sure I usually say that. I'll be like, I'm using really binary language right now because we're talking... Yeah. You know, because in purity culture, there are only two genders.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't mean I believe it, but I'm parroting that rhetoric because I'm trying to make everyone understand.
But it's hard sometimes because, well, one, I'm a grammar Nazi. I mean, that's probably the most white supremacy I am is grammar Nazi.
Grammar Nazi.
So like, you know, when somebody's a they, them, it is so hard to work that into a sentence correctly. And obviously, the people I've met who are non-binary, like they have so much grace and you know, they're not judging you. but it's so hard and you'll trip up. So if I do it today, feel free to correct me.
I will add one thing that might make that more easy for you. And I do this a lot when I'm doing trainings about gender is it is now okay by the APA, the Webster's or Merriam-Webster's Dictionary, all of the literary organizations to use they, them as a single pronoun. And we've been doing it forever without even thinking about it.
Sure.
And if you think about that, I think it makes it a little easier to adjust.
I agree.
It's like, oh, like if I said someone out there gave me coffee, you might say, oh, did they? And like, it's not because you think they're non-binary. It's just because you don't know who they are.
That's a really good way of looking at it. Yeah. But I'm such a personal person. It's like, I'll just put their name in every sentence, but then it gets super awkward.
When you first heard of me and my work, you thought like, well, this person must have been raised similarly.
Yeah.
And I do understand that I am like an outsider to the community of like deconstruction and ex-evangelicals who have welcomed me with open arms. And I know every once in a while, I'm sure there's somebody that's like, well, she doesn't know what she's talking about because she didn't live it. And I'm just really transparent that I didn't live it.
Yeah.
But I also think it's important to be like, no, I didn't live it, but I've been a sex educator since like 1999. So I have a wealth of information that I wouldn't have if I had lived it.
Since she was 14 years old.
Right.
There are probably people who would like, I only want to work with somebody who understands.
Yeah.
Alcoholics Anonymous, the person running it is usually an alcoholic, recovering alcoholic. And I can see why there's that. But to be somebody who helps somebody work through sexual trauma like rape doesn't mean that you need to have been a rape victim to understand what's going on there.
Right.
So again, it's that perfection thing. Like people trying to put others into a mold and jumping on anything. No, I don't think it's important. I just assumed that you were because of your passion and everything you've done for it. Because that feels like a positive vendetta.
Yeah.
And you have it without having gone through it, which I think is even cooler because it shows compassion and empathy. I have a vendetta because I did go through it.
Yeah, exactly.
And like you said, it's something that you didn't choose. It was put on you. And I very much, like, I try not to let get me to a point of anger. But even as I was unpacking it, my wife was trying to help me through it. And she's just like, you know, at times it's frustrating for her because she's dealing with the, you know, the blowback of it. But she's like, I feel horrible because they like snuffed out this beautiful thing and they took it away from you. And you will never be, you'll never be, not like normal, but you'll never be in this place of like pure acceptance. Shame and guilt and all these things will always be in a part of the package when it comes to sex. She's like, and that's so fucked up.
It's so fucked up and unfair. And what I tell my clients when I'm working with them individually is like, nothing's wrong with you. You are not broken and fucked up, but the systems are, and they work exactly like they were designed to.
Yeah.
So like the patriarchal church system intentionally did this shit to you. They're the problem. They're the fucked up thing.
Yeah. But I will say, for any people out there who are going through this and they feel broken and fucked up, you're probably always going to feel that way. Because I do too. And you know better, and you can put in place these things to talk yourself out of that negative talk. But it's hard not to feel that way because kind of like, you know, we talked about alcoholics, you will always be in recovery.
Yeah.
At least that's how I feel. That is a good question, though.
Do it's
you
a long
feel like
game.
Somebody, when you experience trauma, you can get through the point of being able to cope in healthy ways and not let it have major impacts on you. But I don't feel like, I feel like it's always gonna be a part of who I am till the day I die.
I mean, I can't say that that's not the case, but I get so many incredible messages and feedback from people, not just people I've worked with, but people who follow my account, just being like, I want to share this victory with you. My husband and I decided to open our marriage and it's going really well. And I never would have been able to do that if, you know, I hadn't been reading your content or gone through your workbook or whatever. So I see incredible victories happening. And I think that battling the shame is like the longest long game in the world. You know, like it'll get smaller and smaller. You can tamp it out more and more, and it's going to take up less of like the pie chart in your brain. But, you know, even if you're down to a little bit of a sliver, that's way better than than the whole pie. But yeah, I do hear incredible stories from people that are like, I never could have imagined having sex for fun before. I never.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of like having guilt-free sex was like, that's the dream, man.
Yeah.
That's a dream.
And I will say this. I don't know that I've ever said this publicly, maybe once on a podcast, but like, I don't think I've ever felt an ounce of sexual shame in my life. And I say that not to be like, brag, but because
no,
like,
that's like the jealousy. You should feel it pouring over there. I'm like, and what does that feel like?
But I'm like, it just feels like it's like you get to make decisions from an empowered place.
Yeah.
You know, it's never like, oh, I did a thing and now I'm ruminating over how bad I feel. But truly, like, that's where I operate from and where I want to get my clients to is realizing that, like, sex is the most natural thing in the world, and humans, specific groups of humans, have made it so fucking weird and so complicated.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be that way.
Oh my gosh.
When you zoom out, it's like, why? It's also kind of like, why did we establish these like capitalist societies where everyone has to work instead of, you know, have fun all day? But like, sex, why? Like, we have made it so miserably difficult for people.
Obviously, what it goes back to is control. It skews very, it skews race, but it especially skews gender. You know, like you said, there's only two genders in that realm.
Yep.
And women have it way worse than men in growing up. And we've talked about it on the show. It's horrible. Essentially, what has happened in the church was don't do what I do what I say. Premarital sex was not a major topic of conversation in the church, especially because people were getting married at like 14.
Right.
And so like sex was still like one, they wanted to be the sacred thing. There's a verse that a lot of people refer to in this. Corinthians 7:2 is one of them. Because of the temptation of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. And that's really important too, because as we're going to talk about on future episodes about the biblicism, the fact that we use a lot of these terms, like the term homosexual never appeared in the Bible until the 1940s.
Yeah.
And that's, it was sexual deviants and sexual perverts. And they decided those were the same thing. And that's obviously still a drum that the church is banging.
Yeah.
Hebrews 13:4 is another one. Let marriage be held in honor among us. Let the marriage bed be undefiled, and God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous. But you can also point to verses in the Bible that say any kind of sex other than for procreation is wrong. It also says that, like, well, you can beat your wife, you know, just and you can beat your slaves, which means you can also own slaves. Reading the Bible and saying, like, this is a textbook and each line is as defined as everything else. It's poetry at best. It's poetry. And it's a lot of, you know, metaphors and allegories, and it was written by humans who had their own agendas. And so the church has then taken it, turned it into this thing, like, anything other than this sanctioned sex is not okay. And then what it's done is they perpetuated that. They've taught it over and over, and they started to have this like control. And it's very male skewed, because it's like, well, if the guy cheats on his wife, they just need to get their house in order and fix it. The wife cheats on the husband, let's stone her.
Right.
From Houston Moms, there was an article, and this woman said, nearly three decades later, I can definitively say that the most destructive force in my adolescence was not sex itself, but the way sex was framed and used as a source of shame and control.
Yep.
And that's probably the general messaging you get from people in your work.
Absolutely. And it's always, you know, a slightly different flavor. I believe that purity culture in the way we're talking about it today, we're talking about, you know, the like purity culture industry, essentially the like big boom of it. But I think that purity culture is baked into the fabric of America and American society, and the way that it was introduced to generations of young people in the last couple generations is purity culture on steroids.
Yeah.
But in general, like, this is a puritanical society. Our country was, you know, this land was colonized by people who had very conservative views on sexuality. And you can read history about the ways that the white people that came here from England were absolutely disgusted by the sexual practices of the indigenous people that lived here. Mm-hmm. They thought it was ridiculous that they weren't ashamed to be naked. They thought it was disgusting that they had sex for pleasure. They did not like that there was not a clear gender binary like there was in their mm-hmm. community. And that those beliefs have gotten enforced in this country since the country was founded. And
yeah.
You know, you don't have to grow up in the church to even get those messages.
And that's what I was going to say. Like, while a big focus of this is on the church, purity culture absolutely existed yeah. outside the church as well. Anyone who went to public school in the 90s was taught abstinence is mm-hmm. the way.
Yeah.
The Reagan era of education was definitely abstinence.
Abstinence. And, you know, even just the idea of like slut shaming and victim blaming when someone is sexually assaulted, the idea that like a girl can have too much sex and get used up, but it's cool for a boy to like sleep around, like all of that stuff is.
Do you hear a lot
culture.
About the gum thing?
Oh, I do hear about the gum. The gum metaphor is a big one, but I mean, I learn so much from my clients and I tell them this all the time because in some ways I was sheltered from all the shit you all had to deal with.
Yeah.
And I have people being like, hey, you know, in my church, the pastor, someone actually told me the pastor blended up a milkshake and put dog shit in it. Literal took a dog turd out of his yard and put it in a milkshake in a blender.
And said,
this is what happens if you have sex. You who would want this milkshake? Basically, the milk, the dog shit milkshake was a woman who had had sex.
And then every guy in the church is like, I mean, I don't love dog shit, but need to get my milkshake on.
Right. Like, I mean, the metaphors
are disgusting.
Are batshit.
But what's
crazy.
Worse than the metaphors is, like, I was told specifically, if you have premarital sex, you might go to hell. But if you're a really good person, you might get into heaven, but you have to walk through like a lake of fire.
Oh my God.
And the more sexual experiences you have, the longer and bigger and hotter this lake is. And as a 14-year-old or probably younger, let's say a 12-year-old just about to go through puberty, mm-hmm. you're like, yeah, I still think I want to walk through that lake.
Right. And I still want to touch my genitals furiously yeah. and regularly.
Yeah.
Like one of the worst things, I mean, there's so many worse things, but the idea of like making young people, whether they're 3 or 15, feel deep, deep, immense shame and like something is wrong with them for
yeah.
feeling, having sexual thoughts, having sexual feelings. Like,
And you don't own your body.
No.
God owns your body. So, oh, masturbation was a big part of purity culture is like masturbation's bad. But you have somebody who's so sexually repressed and angry and they can't even do that. Like you're in my opinion, you're breeding the next rapist.
I think about it more like if you're telling young men that having sexual thoughts and feelings are so deviant, you're also you're dehumanizing, blaming girls for making you feel that way.
Oh, yeah.
Which really leads to just the idea of women as temptresses and terrible things to be eradicated.
Yeah,
and we've even heard that kind of rhetoric in some of the like mass shootings we've had.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm like, that is definitely taking this conversation on a tangent, but I don't think we can ignore that that rhetoric gets used
yeah.
as like, these women were tempting me. Yeah,
these
women.
Jezebels.
Yes.
The incels, I mean, the big incel movement is like, these women won't have sex with me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because someone owes it to me because, you know, whether or not they realize they're saying it's because there's a hierarchy here and you
yep.
owe me this. And obviously, I'm not saying like not letting someone masturbate is going to make them a rapist, but you're breeding this very mentally unstable, unhealthy person who has no outlet.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that like the sexual stuff isn't just it isn't just emotional and mental. I mean, any guy who's ever had blue balls knows that there's a physiological thing that happens
sure.
in your body.
Yeah.
And so the idea that you're put in a situation where you lose self-control, that to me, that's from a place of some kind of like mental trauma and disturbance. And I think that's exactly what happens in a lot of those situations.
Yeah. Nothing good, regardless of the outcome, can come out of just making people feel like their bodies don't belong to them and are terrible, no matter, you know, what natural things are happening to them. It's like some of the biggest victories I see with my clients are when they are parents and they're like, oh, my three-year-old touched his penis and I told him that it was okay and that he just needed to do it in privacy.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, it's okay, but not at the dinner table at Thanksgiving.
Not at the dentist. No, it's like, yeah, you do it, you know, in the privacy of your own home, but to be able to have a conversation with your child where you recognize the humanity and the normalcy in their sexual development is like, you are breaking the generational curse bullshit when you can do that.
Oh, yeah. We were never told, like, I remember sitting there in the bathtub and I'm like, what's it doing? Mm-hmm. It was just told like, oh, that's just something that happens to boys. Like, don't worry about it. It's like, it would have been nice to have been actually educated on the science. Like, imagine there was no religion, perfect world, right? Imagine you're a caveman and you're just like walking around. All of a sudden you get an erection. You're like, there is no one telling you that this is right or like, wrong or bad. It's like, this is my biology.
It's normal as sneezing.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a thing your body does.
We were just talking about it, kind of like rape and everything. What purity culture did was essentially tried to debunk the idea of consent. Mm. Because a big part of purity culture is like, you can't rape your wife. That is what it is. And also, like, yeah, it's the idea that if you want it and God's a part of it and everything, of course, if you're a man, you can do whatever you want kind of a thing, as long as it's in the sanctioned place. So, of course, you have somebody who's like, well, I already fucked up, so I might as well just do whatever. Mm-hmm. And then women, you get the opposite. It's like, well, I'm already a used, you know, I'm already a dog shit.
Dog shit milkshake.
Yeah. So I might as well just, a lot of the women I've talked to is like, after I had sex the first time, I felt so horrible that I just started getting drunk and having blackout sex. And I'm sure that's a major.
Yeah. Yeah. To be taught you have no value other than in your sexual purity is just pure mind fuckery, like to hinge everything on that.
Yeah. Okay. So I was also doing some research and I read this interesting article and I'm talking about some of the effects of purity culture. Have you heard about this? And I don't know that there's been enough research to be able to say that this is for sure, but patients who were diagnosed with vaginismus. Is that vaginismus, I'll let you explain it, but they're saying that they think that this was triggered by basically by demonizing sex and purity culture teachings.
Yes, this comes up a lot. I'm glad you brought this up because I just collaborated with a expert on the topic to I'll explain that in a moment. But vaginismus for folks who were female assigned at birth means that your pelvic floor muscles are so tight that often when attempting penetration, not just of sex, but even sometimes tampons or fingers or the speculum at the gynecologist, it just absolutely will not go in. Some folks will describe it as like it's like hitting a brick wall. Can also be accompanied by severe pain. It's like there's just no entry to the vagina, essentially. And it is absolutely linked to religious shame.
Yeah.
So many folks.
So while there haven't been enough studies to put it on purity culture specifically, I noticed like there were a lot of things that they noticed in like Muslim women. Mm. And that should, I mean, to me, that tells you right away, because that is they're even more hardcore than evangelicals.
It's purity culture in another religion.
Yeah.
But vaginismus is also something frequently seen in people that have experienced sexual assault.
Right.
Which means, you know, if you want to like peel back the layers, you had a traumatic experience around sex and you were very fearful about sex.
Right.
And purity culture or extreme like religious beliefs around sex do the same thing to folks. So I've worked with so many people that experience difficulty with penetration or pain with penetration, some who have actually been diagnosed with vaginismus and others who are just like admitting for the first time to another human, me, that they're like, I don't think anything can go in there and I don't know what to do. And like, they don't even know how to think about it or talk about it.
Just getting to the point of talking about it out loud was probably the hardest,
for sure,
longest journey anyway, because there's so many things that, I mean, I have them too. Not that I think I'm like the picture of like ideal mental health, but it's like, you just kind of push it behind you. You're like, whatever, that's just how I am. I'm fucked up.
Yeah.
And, you know, saying it out loud sometimes, going into therapy in general, but especially when it's about sex and sex is all the shame, talking about it out loud is, while it's cathartic and therapeutic and whatever it is for each person, it's just hard to get to that point.
Oh, yeah. And I tell everyone I work with, one of the first things I get out of the way when we're starting an appointment or a relationship together is like, I let them know, I understand you're probably really uncomfortable talking about this, and that's okay. And I tell them, like, I've been talking about sex professionally forever, and I don't feel any discomfort on my end. So please don't censor yourself. Please don't feel like you have to talk in a perfect way about it. Just like whatever you want to say.
See, I'm from a family who tells dick jokes at the dinner table.
I am.
That's how you should do it. You break the ice with a dick joke right off the bat.
I mean, I'm just seriously in a text thread with my mom and sister right now. I sent some joke about, like, you know, you probably heard like the rumor about Nancy Reagan giving all the head. And like we're joking about that. And then in my big family group text, I sent them some like dick related joke meme this morning. And that group text has like my dad, my mom, my brother, his wife, my sister.
Yeah, that's
my family.
I wish my family was like that. So we would have text threads and we would always play like these games where like people were saying the grossest stuff. Anything sex was off the table though.
Yeah.
Because while my dad one-on-one would joke, my mom is just like, you don't joke about mm-hmm. that. You're not allowed to joke about God and you're not allowed to joke about sex. And mm-hmm. of course, that's all I wanted to joke about. So I'd have to be clever. But like, yeah, I mean, that's the sad thing. So if you get into evangelical culture and everything, they're far more comfortable with you making super racist, sexist, and every type of jokes, but not about sex mm-hmm. and not about God. You're not allowed to. What did I say one time? I made a Jesus joke that wasn't even really bad. And it was just like because my dad was raised Catholic. So he's very much in the belief of the Old Testament God, you know, fire and brimstone. So he's looking at me like, am I going to get hit by a bolt of lightning?
You will be smote.
I'm like, let's see. Yeah, she used that correctly.
Smote.
Did you know?
I looked at you for a second like, did I use it correctly?
You did. Smote is the past tense of smited by God. I get that. You know, everyone should feel like something's sacred or off limits, I guess. But it's like, if you believe in God and he invented you and sense of humor, like, pretty sure he could take a joke better than anybody. So, whatever.
Well, my sense of humor is... I mean, in addition to just being chill about sex, I was also raised on Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah.
Like that was peak my teen years. Yeah. And I still find it the most hilarious thing. And I also love to throw a That's What She Said into conversation.
Who doesn't? Tyler. So Tyler, who's here today, but he does it in a way where it's just so obnoxious.
Oh, like the more obnoxious, the better.
Yeah. To the point where it's like 40 in a day. And I'm like, just save one. Michael Scott, just save one. And every once in a while, he'll pull out a good one. I'm like, that was good. That was good.
Yeah. Magic engine light was on when I reached the Rio Grande. We had ending come on, but I wished I had a band.
Hey, we're on the East Coast, so we might as well pop on over to Long Island, where our musician spotlight shines on the Bell Curves. Long Island may not be the first place that comes to mind when you think of country Americana with a strong rural connection, but you might think differently after spending some time with the work of singer-songwriter Delaney Hafner. As the driving force behind the Bell Curves, she has a way of turning your assumptions upside down. Whatever preconceived notions you harbor about country music, the USA, love, relationships, identity, or belonging, you'll likely find yourself gazing from a newfound vantage point after hearing a few tracks from the Bell Curves. You can check them out on Instagram at the.belle.curves or thebellcurves.bandcamp.com/music.
Thank you.
So how I was introduced to you was through my own therapist who had me go through your workbook. And I brought my dirty, beat up, natty, like grease stained version of it.
I do need to take a photo of this at some point
because
I have never seen my workbook printed out and used. Like, it makes me feel so good to
and
see
used
that.
Is the term. It's used, abused. This is the dog shit puree. No. So I found this to be one of the most comprehensive, well thought out from a not only shame-free way of unpacking sexuality, but shame-free in the sense of if you still feel this other way, that's okay too.
Yeah.
It's all questions and it's written in such a beautifully human, fun, like very much your personality.
Yeah.
I already had an idea of your personality just going through this book. You know, it's just kind of like, hey, you know, they fuck you up.
Yeah.
Whatever. Let's do
now
this together.
Now we're gonna unfuck you.
Yeah.
And if you still feel fucked up, don't worry, baby. You'll be fine.
And we'll get you fucked, but in a fun way.
Right.
So is there anything specifically that you were, when you were creating this workbook, that you were like, I don't know if I want to, should this be included? Should this not? Or is this its own section? Or should I put this in this? Because it, you know, if you go through the workbook, which I highly recommend everybody to do this, whether or not you were raised evangelical. In fact, I think it's important to see what your views are on some of these things.
Yeah.
And we'll talk through what some of them looked like. Was there anything that you felt like, maybe this doesn't fit, or maybe this should be part of this? Or
I really wanted to be so comprehensive. And we've all heard the term comprehensive sex education, but I don't think most people like know what that really means.
I think of what they made us go through in school and it was not comprehensive.
No.
But they would call it comprehensive.
Yeah. So
we covered penis and vagina. I think we're done.
Right. And if you talk about STDs and how not to get pregnant, that's basically it. And that is not comprehensive. Those of us who work in the sexuality field know that talking about the like nitty gritty details of how sex happens in a biological sense is a tiny fraction of the topic of sexuality. And that's what I really wanted to embody in this workbook is like, so you might need to think about how you feel about the act of sex, but we're also going to talk about all the other factors that come into play. And that's where I pulled out the circles of sexuality. And that's something I learned in grad school. When I was in grad school to be a sex educator, we learned about the five circles of sexuality. Yep.
Which you probably have memorized, but I have them right here.
I have them memorized in a sense. But in addition to the like nuts and bolts reproduction circle, there's also like the things we learn about intimacy, the things we learn about sexualization, meaning like power involved in sex, the things we learn about how to be in relationships, the things we learn about gender and sexual identity. Is that covering all? Sensuality. Sensuality is the one I forgot. That's like the
most important one.
Sex, the sex feeling good, the reason why we touch each other, the reason why we want to feel pleasure. So we have to think about all of these topics when we're deconstructing values, because it's not just like, hey, do you believe a penis should go in a vagina? Like, that's not deconstructing sexuality values. I wanted to ask people to think about all of those things, and knowing that folks would not have any idea where to start.
Yeah.
I broke it down in those clear categories. And then I made sure to emphasize specially abortion and porn.
Yes.
Because I was like, they need their own little section.
Yeah.
Because those are some of the hottest topics that I think get just bulldozed by the religious right. And so that's why I did it the way I did it. And like low key, I'm going to be expanding this into an actual book in the future. I'm one of those people that's like, I'm working on a book, and I've been saying that for years. I'm one of those.
Yeah. I totally get it, because a book is a totally different project.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're working on a film for, you know, if a film goes on for a few years, that's crazy. But a book, it's because it's constantly morphing. And if you're not in the mood to write.
Yeah.
But I can only imagine how much information you have to put into it. It's more about what should I just cut out because of all the things you've gone through. But I find it extremely comprehensive. And it's funny because what it kind of told me was I can on paper completely intellectualize and rationalize everything. It's this emotional fuckery, as you said,
yeah,
that is so hard to get through. Because in a vacuum, all of this makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. But and what she does in this workbook too is, it's not that she dictates things or tries to tell you how to feel.
Yep.
It's very much you asking yourself, which that's is the hardest part for some people.
That's my entire philosophy in sex education, regardless of whether I'm working with someone raised in purity culture or like my old work, which was with youth in detention. I'm never here to tell you what to think. I'm never here to tell you what to do. But I think the most important job of a sex educator is to be like, here are all the facts. How do you feel? What do you think? What decisions will you make based on this information?
And so what's funny is, what gets lost in some of all of the purity culture stuff and even unpacking the trauma is like the face value of things that you're like, God, I've never stopped and thought about it. I didn't have a ton of ahas. It's like, yeah, I know, but.
Yeah, I'm curious. Was there parts that you were like, oh shit, I really never thought about this, or this one's.
It was almost always the most obvious. So one of them was about virginity. What do you think about virginity? And even though we know it's all about virginity in the purity culture sense, it's really about don't have sex at all. And like the first time, I think it showed kind of my own privilege of the first time for a guy isn't that big of a deal. It's kind of like shit. But the idea, it had me really stop and think about it, is like, you're losing something.
Mm-hmm.
You're losing this sacred thing the Virgin Mary. It's like why virginity is so important. And to really think about it, I guess the aha for me was when I challenged myself to think about it. I'm like, wait a second. Why is it such a big deal?
Yeah.
Not saying that sex isn't a big deal or that your first time shouldn't be unique important. Or special or whatever it is to you. It's an important part of your journey as a human. But I'm like, why the fuck is it? It's like, not like I remember my first time I ate a burger. Who, like, that's great. That's great. And now I eat burgers all the time.
Right. They're delicious.
It was so obvious. I'm like, oh yeah, it's all about virginity. It was like questions you don't ask yourself because you're so focused on one thing.
Yeah, and the concept of virginity is life-changingly important, is just so normalized that sometimes it's like, why would I even question that? Unless somebody else asked me to question it.
And that's it.
If I asked you to go through like the main values that purity culture sort of rests on and confront those main values, that's one of them. And it's like, I write it out like, do you believe that virginity is this hard line definition, immutable thing that is super important? And then kind of the other side of that belief is that virginity is a social construct and that it can be lovely to have sex for the first time, but it doesn't change your entire life.
Right.
And then I ask people, where do you stand in between those beliefs? Like, what do you think about it?
I'll tell you what. Pick a random page.
Oh, okay.
And I'll read the questions and I'll even read my answers live.
Oh, fun. I'm just going to flip through like I'm a dealer at a casino. Yeah. I'm just going to pick a page.
My luck, it's going to be a bust on 22.
Let's talk about the queer and trans stuff. Is that okay?
Yeah,
that's totally where I landed. And also I should say this, as I say to my clients, like, yes, I'm a queer person, but that doesn't mean that you have to give answers that you think I want to hear.
No, I'm going to read you exactly what I wrote.
Cool.
So you have a rating scale that's like one is like strongly disagree and 10 is strongly agree.
Yeah.
So you have on here, knowledge of queer and trans identities is harmful to children. And I wrote 2.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be honest. I'm that person who hates filling out the thing that where it's all ones and tens.
Yeah.
So I usually try to like really dig and see like, is this what I actually think or is this a gut feeling?
Mm-hmm.
I put a 2, and you can challenge me on all my answers. I put a 2 because meaning it's not quite the lowest because I don't think it's harmful. I guess it's slightly above, not because I think it is harmful. I don't think it exists,
mm-hmm.
but I'm like, I could see how trying to be as objective as possible, just because a little boy likes putting on dresses doesn't mean he's trans.
Mm-hmm.
Like as a kid, I loved playing dress up, but you could have some of those parents who Kind of like what happened with Gypsy Rose, whatever, the Munchausen system. Oh. So it's like, oh, I have a trans kid, and oh, look at me. I'm looking at extreme circumstances.
You know, I do agree with that. I've seen that kind of thing play out. And I, you know, it's no secret that I also work specifically with trans youth and their families through a major hospital. And I don't talk about that much because of how much we're under attack by certain people. But yeah,
you can
I think,
say who. Yeah, that's fine.
I mean, you can. This is why I wrote these questions.
I kind of want you to ask me the next question,
okay.
And I'm going to answer how I think I answer or how I actually feel. Let's see if I'm close.
Basically, it's agree or disagree. One being strongly
disagree,
and 10 being strongly agree. I support the right of people to explore their gender identities.
Oh, of course. I mean, okay. Growing up in the era I grew up, the Beavis and Butthead era, you make fun of everybody.
Yeah.
And so you'd make fun of the gay kid, or you might make fun of the guy wearing the dress, but do you actually really hate them? It was like, no, it's just, you know, you're goofy. I'm not excusing that behavior, but deep down, there was no part of me that ever had a problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, like, I never really had a problem with somebody who was gay. The first person who ever came out to me, I was like, well, no shit. Like, you think I haven't known that the whole time? Like, I don't care. I've never understood that. Even being raised, I watched conversion therapy when I was like 9 years old, happened in the church. I've talked about it on the show.
Deeply makes my stomach hurt just thinking about watching conversion therapy.
Even though I'm in church and I have all the guilt and I have all the shame and I'm being told that this is a beautiful thing, I knew what I was watching was wrong.
Yeah.
I was like, why are you doing this to these poor people who obviously are unhappy and miserable that you're forcing them? And they were like, it was a gay man and a gay woman. And they were like, now we're dating each other. And I'm like, you want to talk about taking fun out of sex. Can you imagine what the sex like that? Being forced to have sex with somebody because you're afraid of burning in hell that you are completely not into. I mean, that's like third party rape. I don't know how you. Yeah. So anyway, go to whatever you want.
I want to go to the pornography section just because that is, I just taught like a big class on it and I'm very passionate about how much evangelicals have hijacked the entire porn conversation.
So let's talk about porn, and I want you to go to mine and I will let you candidly read my answers out loud.
Okay.
Seriously, I'm actually very interested to hear what I say.
Yeah.
I think I have an idea of what I'm going to say about porn. We wanted to do a full episode on porn.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I think we should at some point, but I also think it's part of the purity culture stuff. And I didn't want to hijack this conversation because I do think it's important to talk about porn. Because porn is a scale, I think, of where it's unhealthy, not as a viewer necessarily, but the porn industry. It's kind of like any kind of sex work when you demonize it and you take it and say it's illegal and you do all of these things, it's going to happen in an unhealthy fashion. I think porn's been that way. And I think with the innovations of like OnlyFans and things like that, I think we're moving into a healthier version of it where the women who are involved, because let's be honest, it's largely women who are involved in the porn industry, at least where the major dollars are spent. They have full control over what it is that's happening.
Creating their own content. So part of what I do in this workbook is I write a sentence and I ask people to, do you think this is always true, sometimes true, or never true? And some of those sentences are, I wrote, pornography can be created in an ethical fashion. And you said sometimes, and I absolutely agree with that on my end.
It's hard to say always or never because I feel like there are very few absolutes in life.
Yeah.
And so take that with a grain of salt. I think the answer is like almost all the time, yes. I obviously, that's just not how it happens. So,
and I mean, when I taught my class on porn in August, I guess that was, one of my guests is a woman who is a pretty big named porn star. And she shared that like, she has felt more disrespected being a server and a waitress than on a porn set.
I've watched documentaries and stuff. The actual people making it are, especially in modern day, are actually very respectful.
Yeah.
And like a lot of the guys and stuff are like very female friendly. Some of them aren't even straight and they're just doing it for acting and you know, make some money. And they're just like, what do you want me to do? What do you want me not to do?
And not every set is going to be like that. There are plenty of examples of coercion, of trafficking, plenty of examples of real fucked up stuff. But if you were on a mainstream porn set nowadays, you actually go through a consent agreement with your partner. Yeah. So it's like a checklist where it's like, I'll do this, but I won't do this today. And I don't want you to, you know, pull my hair today. Or like, you really hash it out in a way that like, that doesn't happen if you're just having sex with your someone you meet on the street,
actually,
you know.
every evening before bed, I have my wife fill out a full form. I'm like, what do you
Here's
want?
The checklist.
It's mostly don't kiss me, don't touch me, no eye contact. I'm kidding.
Okay, here's another question. Let's see. So the statement I wrote was, consuming pornography can damage a person's respect of women. And you wrote, sometimes, what are they watching?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of porn that exists where it perpetuates like dominance in an unhealthy sense, where it's, you know, like the casting calls and things where when you read the stories, because the true stories of like the Girls Gone Wild type stuff.
Yeah.
I think it definitely shows like for the cost of a hat or a free t-shirt, you can have sex with whoever you want. And these women are drunk, so who gives a shit anyway?
And I do think, you know, if a young, like a young person, a young man is only looking at that kind of stuff and doesn't have anyone to give him context or anyone to talk to him about his values and about consent, then, you know, I don't think that is great. Let me see. I love this answer. So the question is, pornography use is okay when people are in a monogamous relationship. And you said always, but let me tell you, just today I saw a post going around from, you know, some woman who has an Instagram account where she's, you know, educating about something. And her post was like, porn is cheating. Watching porn is cheating.
That's so fucking stupid.
I agree with you.
Like, as somebody who has his own hangups on sex, I've talked to so many guys and they're like, I won't watch it because she gets mad. And I'm like, that has nothing to do with you. That is something she has not worked through. That is a jealousy thing. And I'm not saying she's fucked up, but anybody who's like, I understand jealousy. Mm-hmm. We've all felt it. I've definitely felt it in certain areas. Like, even if you're in the most monogamous of relationships, that person thinks about and looks at, and even during sex, thinks about other people. It is human nature. You know, it's like teaching purity culture in any form or fashion. You're trying to take something that is inhuman and say this is something to strive for.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pornography is a healthy outlet. Let's say you're in a relationship with somebody who cannot or will not do a sexual act, but you fantasize about it. Watch it.
Yeah. Watch it. Think about it. I mean, I do a lot of teaching of my clients about how, like, having sexual thoughts and feelings about someone that's not your monogamous partner doesn't mean shit. It just means you're human. You can't control looking at someone and finding them hot. Like, and trying to control that is just a dead end of frustration.
What are your thoughts? So, I mean, you've talked about it a little bit, you know, either ethical non-monogamy or any kind of opening up, whether it's soft, whatever you want to call it. And so you've hinted at it a few times of open relationships. And I guess I kind of want to debunk the idea that monogamy is the only thing that works.
Yep. And that's a wonderful sentence right there. Like, monogamy is not the only thing that works. Some people feel naturally drawn to only being with one partner, and that is perfectly fucking fine. But if you don't, that's also okay, as long as everyone involved is consenting to that arrangement. And you can have deep, loving connections with more than one person. It's not a lack of commitment if you are having other sexual partners, as long as you and your, you know, if you are married or you are in a primary committed partnership, like, if everyone is okay with what's happening, it requires a lot of conversation, a lot of negotiation, a lot of communication.
That's what I was going to say. From the people I've met and the conversation that I've had, and after that finale, I was like, I want to go out there and kind of experience the world. And we went to a sex club, and we were just meeting people and talking to them, and you know, it's such a spectrum. It's not this
I've
one
never
thing.
Been to a sex club. You've outdone me.
You would be so bored because it's like you hear the real juicy stuff. But everyone, I think a lot of people have one, they have this stigma that they go, oh, they're swingers. Like, swinging could mean a million different things. And a lot of times, I think what people are seeing that gets sensationalized is bored people who are like, we're just going to try this.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people who are actually living in a lifestyle where they're like, no, we both agree to all these things. And I was going to say, the one thing I've seen is the couples who are doing something other than your just standard monogamy are far more in tune, far more in love, and far more like communicating openly and transparently with each other than the people in their standard monogamous relationships. Because those people, a lot of them from the get-go, are not being fully honest with their partner or themselves because they're like, I don't watch porn. Yeah, you do, bro. Mm-hmm. You just don't do it when she's around.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say, just to like co-sign what you're saying, you have to put thoughtful intention into a non-monogamous relationship. But a lot of people enter monogamy without ever thinking about it deeply, without ever talking about it deeply. They just do it because it's the thing to do.
Yeah.
And one term or concept that I like to teach people about is the idea of the relationship escalator. And that is our big cultural belief that a relationship must progress in certain ways to be valid. Right. And that it's like you meet, you commit, and you are monogamous until one of you dies. That's our relationship escalator. But there's,
except for the fact that the divorce rate is probably over 50% today, and that cheating is like crazy.
Just the thing people do. It's rampant. Yeah. People climb the relationship escalator with very, very little thoughtful intention. And to be someone who creates a model of a relationship that doesn't climb the escalator means you have to be intentional and you have to be thoughtful and you have to put effort into it. And I think that that can be beautiful and that you can have beautiful relationships that are monogamous or not. It's not the only way to be. And it can be really, really, really scary to think about a non-monogamous relationship. It can be really scary to challenge your own personal feelings about what that might mean for you. But doing it is so worth it. And I know so many people who have gone from purity culture to polyamory, and it works for them.
I would imagine so. If you can get past the shame and guilt, otherwise you're like, I have shame with so many people.
It would be a whole other episode, but I would like to go off for a moment about the concept of porn as an addiction.
Do you not think that people can become addicted to porn?
I believe that people, and I'm talking from the view of someone in the sexuality field who has read a lot of research about this and who...
But don't take her too seriously. She's never been to a sex club. I'm guessing she's never made a porn. No, I'm kidding.
So what the research says is that absolutely, people can have problematic behaviors around pornography and behaviors that they feel that are interrupting and disrupting their lives.
Yeah.
But when you actually study the brain and how people's brains respond on pornography, it does not mimic at all other addictions. There's actually less brain activity when people are exposed to pornography when they are self-described addicts than there would be if they were like drug addicts and are given drugs. Also, multiple studies have shown that religious beliefs are the biggest predictor of a person saying that they're an addict to porn. So if you were raised very religiously, you are so much more likely to perceive your behavior around porn as an addiction and a problem. And that might mean there are people that might watch porn once a month and perceive that they're addicted because that's what they've been told.
I could see that.
Yeah. I mean, I worked with somebody one time who said he watched porn maybe 4 or 5 times a year and was sent to an addiction program by his wife and minister.
So my opinion is not all that important, but here's my thoughts on it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, it's not like alcohol has actual addictive behaviors, just like nicotine and other things. It's not like porn is the bad guy in it. It's that people can have really unhealthy coping mechanisms. Yep. But I feel like porn is a false reality for some people. And I feel like that's somebody who plays too much video games. Like, yeah, you can become addicted, but it's not like the video games are bad.
Right. And there is... I will self-promote for a minute.
Please do.
If you purchase my porn conversation class for Purity Culture Dropouts, I go into intense detail about this. But yes, like there are some of the...
There's some guy who searched for that on Pornhub and he's like, at the end of this video, I didn't get off, but I really learned some information.
I learned so much. Totally possible. Some of the researchers have found that like the ways that people use porn are just like masking other problems they have. For some, it's
for
like
sure.
Masking ADHD. For some, it's masking their desire to disengage from real life and just, you know, float off in fantasy world because life, their real life is difficult. Like, those are ways that people use porn. So again, I'm not saying it never is problematic in people's lives, but the idea that it's an addiction that needs to go to an addiction center that's always religious based, where they continue to shame you and make you feel like more of an addict and you'll need their services more, is a huge fucking racket.
I agree.
And sex addiction researchers want people to get the help they need. They just don't believe that using the addiction model is the help they need.
Exactly. I agree 100%. You're dealing with some kind of behavioral coping mechanism or sexual trauma. And it's funny because if you were to read my answers top to bottom, you'd be like, oh yeah, this guy's experienced some bullshit. Porn, for some reason, is like my healthiest view. And I think it's the disassociation with like, oh, this isn't reality.
You know, what's so funny is I did not know you were, when I picked the porn section to look at, it was because I thought that would be a difficult one for you, because for so many men raised like you were, it is one of their most difficult topics. So you were kind of an anomaly in my experience.
Oh, I am a dog shit milkshake. Let me tell you, like if you were to read this top to bottom, you might like turn me into the cops bag. I think I found the Unabomber. It's the things that I found out about myself are so bizarre, and I know other people have to experience it, but it's so different because you're not one thing. Somebody who's experienced trauma in this sense, you can't put yourself in a bucket, and I think that's what makes it difficult. And it is, you read through some of it. I guess I've had a healthy relationship with porn.
Well, this is great. I feel like I'm going to client you for a minute. If you were my client, I would be like, bro, this is such a victory. And if you can feel that non-shame feeling you feel around porn, you can carry that into other areas of sexuality.
I don't know. I've just been able to compartmentalize it and go like, I mean, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Why can't I view regular sex? Client me, please. Like, fix me.
Yeah.
How many people come to you and just go, please fix me?
Sometimes they do that, but I'm always like, no, I'm just going to guide you on fixing yourself.
So I have a few last questions.
Sure.
You're an attractive woman. If you look like Dr. Ruth, this might not be an issue, right? Do you get transference from your patients? And for those of you who don't know what that is, transference is like when you start to get create feelings for somebody like your doctor, your therapist. But especially because you're talking about sex. So somebody who's having a sexual breakthrough. I worked with a therapist who's very good looking. And I was like, Matt, don't even let your brain go there. Because part of my sexuality is kind of like, she's hot. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's just how my brain works.
That's normal.
I have to imagine it's been something you've dealt with. And how do you deal with it if you ever get that?
So I think that, by and large, the people I've worked with closely, if they ever have had feelings like that, they are really good at boundaries and not saying anything. I can think of one time with somebody that I feel like, also, I think it's important to note that I'm not just a person that has clients. I have like a big Instagram account. So people often form like parasocial relationships
with me
where they like feel like they know me a lot better than they actually do. And I think there's been one instance where like a younger woman who's a lesbian has definitely tested the boundaries a little. And I just keep it 100% professional, never even respond to these, never respond to the flirtation.
Because look, I'm putting myself in what would be your client's place. And it's because you're talking about and unpacking the most intimate part of somebody.
Yeah.
And it's like we experienced this together. So now there's this bond mm-hmm. about sex. Therefore, that means I sexually am attracted to you, right? Mm-hmm. I would think, unless the person is not into women whatsoever, like that would come into play at some point. And it's got to be tricky, but at the same time, somebody, I wanted to ask that question, and then I did more research, and going through my own journey, I was like, it's probably less of an issue than I would think, because it's so much work, and it's so much trauma that, like, you get there, you're like, I feel more like we went to battle together,
totally.
Not so much that, like...
I will say that I have formed some really wonderful friendships with people, because I'm not a therapist, so I don't have the same, like... I don't have to hold the same sort of like clinical therapeutic code of ethics right. where I can't talk to you at all about my life outside of right. my work. So there are folks that have moved from client to friend, and we relate to each other more as like, yeah, like just as bros and friends now. And I like to have that flexibility, but
you have called me bro a few times, so I feel like I'm part of the inner
bro.
Circle.
You are, yep.
You're like the dream therapist that I think most people want and strive for. And even our, you know, other therapists who I've met, that's why they idolize you a little bit. Like you were saying earlier, how it's been so like heartwarming and reaffirming, but there are so many people who themselves are awesome and who still look to you as like this. She has got this shit like nailed down. She's awesome.
Thank you. I mean,
I'm just human.
Completely myself. I don't know how else to be. I'm just like, I'm a goofy ass lady that has a toilet sense of humor.
I'm kind of upset more of it didn't come out because that podcast is all about toilet humor.
Like, I will make dick jokes all day. Yeah. I will say D's nuts as many times as I can. But I'm also really, really good at what I do. And I don't try to get rid of that, the real part of me, to be like somebody's idea of professional, because I don't think that makes a connection with people.
There's nothing more disarming when you got to talk about something so tough than somebody who's you don't feel judged by. You just feel like this person's got the tools I don't have.
Yeah.
And yeah, I can totally see. And I'm very surprised that you've been doing this for 20 years, because meeting you in person, I would think this person's 10 years younger than me.
So. I'm 43. And happy to be 43, deeply proud to be a woman in my 40s.
Yeah.
Like, I always tell people it just gets better. No need to be afraid.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's go to one more happy place. One thing is, you mention it in your book, you mention it online a lot. You are an animal lover.
Oh my God,
You have a haven for animals in your house.
I do. Yeah, I'm... my whole family was always animal lovers, and I married an animal lover, and we have 2 rescue dogs and 4 rescue cats, and we live in a row home in Philadelphia, and they're our little family. We are very a decidedly child-free couple, but we fucking love animals, and we rescue them a lot, and my husband is like the cat whisperer of Mount Airy. If anyone finds a stray cat, they like call him up, and they're like, can you come trap this cat? Actually, just as I was leaving to do this recording, he pulled me into the room to show me a cat out the window that he's like, I'm going to take this cat and my friend's going to adopt it. So yeah, that's a big part of my life, is like being a cat lady, being a dog lady, caring for my animals and having them around me. That's just makes me happy and part of who I am.
We were in town in Philadelphia to film at a conference, and there was one place where it was a puppy park, and they knew it's just going to draw people in.
Yeah.
And it wasn't Puppy Mills. It was like the Humane Society. Mm-hmm. And I went in there and I got to play with just these puppies who were far more interested in beating the shit out of each other. And I was like, how many of them are up for adoption? They said all of them. I go, how many can I adopt? They're like, all of them.
Oh, my gosh. You're going to go back to Cleveland with a car full of puppies.
who doesn't love Tyler? Well, Tyler, that's fine. He's already going to have to run behind it. Where can people find you? Where can they follow you? And if somebody's interested in your services, I'm assuming you do remote.
Yes, everything is remote. So my website's purityculturedropout.com, easy to remember. My Instagram is ericasmith.sex.ed. Erica is spelled with a C. And when you go to my website, that's where you can find all the info about working with me, whether that's just for a one-on-one consult, which would be like an hour, or you sign up to do the Purity Culture Dropout program, which is a more intensive ongoing thing. I also have all of the classes I've taught, all the webinars I do are available on my website, and the Sexual Values Workbook is available on my website. The porn class is the most recent one I did, and I'm like extremely proud of that. I worked so hard on that class. And yeah, I also mentioned a vaginismus type project I was working on with another woman. So if you go to my social media or go to my sign up for my newsletter, you can get information about that too.
And I highly recommend going through the workbook for everybody, even if you don't feel like you have had any kind of purity culture trauma or influence in your life. I highly recommend it because it is a great conversation to have with yourself, where there's some form of accountability to putting answers. And then it really helps you unpack, how do I view this? Because even if you have a really sexual, like a healthy sexual relationship, it doesn't mean that there's some things that you've never thought about. And even myself, somebody who obviously is constantly having internal conversations, there were aha moments and questions in there. And I'm like, well, shit, why have I never thought about this?
I mean, I truly think that people who deconstruct from purity culture have thought more thoughtfully and intentionally about sex than the average person on the street.
Far too much.
100%. That is true.
Well, thank you so much for doing this episode, for being here, and for doing what you do, because people like you are making it possible for people like me to try to at least hope to see sex in a healthy way and have healthy, fun sex.
Thank you so much.
So all of us out there watching that porn and feeling bad about it, thank you from all of us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
We just went there. Now you can go to thegoingtherepodcast.com for links to all the podcast platforms, our socials, and of course, YouTube. While you're at it, give us a rating, share with a friend, and subscribe. Make sure to check out today's musician spotlight, The Bell Curves. You can check them out on Instagram at the.bell.curves or thebellcurves.bandcamp.com.
This podcast is made possible by its hosts and Frame One Media in association with Joe Calley and Bobby Thomas.